of course, Mr. You said Lexus, is that correct?
Lexus, the C is silent.
Okay, Lexus, okay. So you're going first, and then on the respondent, I guess Mr. White's going first, and then Mr. Croson, is that correct? I don't hear Mr. Croson. I think he's on the phone, but I'm not sure. Mr. Croson here?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay, very well, okay. All right, so Mr. Lexus, would you like to proceed, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. Levy Lesius on behalf of the appellees in this action.
Your sound is down quite a bit. Can you turn up the volume a little bit? It's better.
So Levy Lesius appearing on behalf of the appellees in this action. If I could please reserve 2 minutes of my time.
Okay, we'll try to help.
Watch the clock.
Okay.
As the panel doubtless appreciates, there are very significant public policy ramifications to this action. A affirmance of the lower court decision would effectively be a license to the subjects of federal investigations to sponsor, underwrite, and affirmatively support all litigation and effectively terrorism via litigation against the informants and witnesses in a federal prosecution. That is fundamentally what the VWPA sought to curtail. And it's simply inconsistent with the VWPA to reach the outcome that the district court reached. Now, there are two ways of attacking it, and that's even without getting to the sham litigation exception. Now, before getting to the constitutional issues, I'll just note that appellees respectfully request that the court reach the constitutional issues, even though it's extremely simple to reverse this outcome simply based on the misapplication of the sham litigation exception, because the district court effectively flipped the serial litigation exception on its head. The premise of the serial litigation exception is that when you have a serial wave of suits, and some of them have very big red flags, that allows scrutiny into all the other successful suits. What the district court did here was the precise opposite. The district court said, if you've obtained the occasional success, we will not look at those other cases with the red flags. So, in appellant's view, the district court flipped the serial suit exception on its head, and reversal is appropriate on those grounds alone. However, we respectfully request reaching the constitutional issues because, in appellant's view, we don't want to be limited in the lower court to the confines of the serial litigation exception. And so, whether from a constitutional standpoint or from a Noah Pennington standpoint, our position is fundamentally that the petition clause is not implicated. And the reason is Congress is simply balancing petition clause rights. I am here today. I have 10 minutes on the clock. My client's petition clause rights are not being limited simply by the fact that I only have 10 minutes to argue today. That is simply outcome that's simply a judgment that in order to provide everybody the equal opportunity to petition the government, there needs to be some limitations. Congress reasonably imposed a limitation on petitions on serially suing a witness and informant, right, to the extent that doing so would result in witness retaliation and intimidation. And I'd like to point out for Your Honor's specific reference that in ER 78, we actually alleged that witnesses were not showing up in the Santa Monica trial because they told Mr. Pick, you know, we love you and all, but we don't want to be the next Harold Pick. And so when you have, and it was also alleged in ER 60, that there are other people engaged in litigation with Mr. K, which witnesses hang up the phone when they hear that who's involved. So Congress reasonably...
Counselor, can I ask you a question? You keep talking about Congress. North Pennington is a judicial doctrine, is it not? What are you reciting that comes from Congress that has anything to do with what we're talking about here?
Well, Your Honor, Norr Pennington is not, you know, it's not decided under Article 3 or the court's inherent powers. It's premised in the First Amendment right to petition.
Right, but the First Amendment is a constitutional right that was adopted long ago. This is not a new congressional statute, is it?
No, Your Honor, and with respect to the VWPA, you know, and this comes to, I guess, what, you know, the, under the third step of this circuit's Norr Pennington jurisprudence, looking at the third step, the congressional history is clear that Congress sought to plug every hole that previously existed in Section 1503 and Section 1505. And even I'll also point out to a point which was made in the ER 75 and 76, which is Congress, the congressional history shows that Congress sought to eliminate the court's prior propensity to apply the justem generis rule to 10505. And courts were saying, well, you need to show a act of retaliation or intimidation that fits within the examples of the statute. Congress said, we want to get rid of that. We just want to outlaw any act. And this is again, under Section 1514, this circuit has affirmed anti-suit injunctions, right, based on the premise that a lawsuit can be an act of intimidation that is the focus of the act. And this once again comes to the language of 1515, I believe it's subsection C or might be subsection E, that where Congress created the safe harbor for attorneys. And as noted in the briefing, Congress specifically put in the statutory language twice that the statutory safe harbor is only for attorneys. And that again reflects a congressional intent to affirmatively outlaw a campaign of sponsoring and underwriting litigation against a whistleblower. And
so let me ask you, because you're going to run out of time, just a very specific question about your corporate bribery allegations.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you were granted leave to amend, what additional facts would you add to those allegations?
Thank you, Your Honor. The additional facts which would be alleged would be referencing the additional allegations would reference Mr. Carlson's deposition testimony, in which he testified that no person besides for him and his predecessor and people within his litigation department knew about this relationship with third parties with a very checkered history. Why that's significant ties again to the
issue. What's the bribery there?
So that relates to the code of conduct of.
What's the bribery? I know what bribery means. I don't see it. Isn't that what you just said or in the complaint? What's the bribery?
So our inference is that because the NYSE compliant code of conduct would preclude lower level employees.
I'm still waiting to hear what the bribery is, not to mention what private cause of action your client would have to be able to enforce that code of conduct. But let's start with what's the bribery? I still haven't seen any sign of bribery.
Your Honor, our allegation is that he acted, that we have somebody who's used the corporate goodwill outside his scope of authorization.
He's got a judgment. He's part of Motorola. They've got a judgment. He's got an opportunity to pursue the judgment. Where's the bribery?
Your Honor, and this...
Where's the bribery? Simple question. Any sign at all of money changing hands in an illicit way?
Your Honor, under the corporate bribery statute, it's about any exchange of value, and appellants concede that it's an inference drawn on a lower-ranking employee with limited authority authorizing a joint relationship with a third party in a way that seems inconsistent with that particular agent's signing authority.
Maybe in your judgment, but you're not the one making that decision, are you? Still don't see any sign of bribery, and if that's the best you got, okay.
That's the best we got, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, you're almost out of time. You want to save what there's left of your time, or you want to continue with it?
No, Your Honor, I think I'll submit.
Okay, very well. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so I believe, Mr. White, you're going to take 8 minutes, if I understand correctly. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, I want to call the court's attention to inconsistency in the argument that counsel's made. In trying to explain why the Victim Witness Protection Act somehow clearly indicated that it was intended to burden petitioning rights, counsel said that, well, from this you can see that Congress intended to burden serial lawsuits. But that's not actually the appellant's arguments. It would be one thing if they were arguing that you can't do sham lawsuits that fall into one of the sham exceptions of the Noor Pennington Doctrine. But appellants are arguing beyond that, that even non-sham lawsuits, any lawsuits where they can't even plead one of the exceptions for the sham exception, can be not only violation of the Victim Witness Protection Act, but RICO. And what you see as a result is a situation where appellants are arguing that they have been injured for purposes of RICO by the fact that Motorola won a case in the state trial court. Winning a case has been turned into a RICO action, and not being able to plead any of the necessary facts for any of the sham litigation exceptions to Noor Pennington is being hand waved away on the idea that somehow the Victim Witness Protection Act clearly indicates an intent to do that. But it simply doesn't. Counsel has cited no clear language in the statute. And in fact, the statute has the exception that counsel referred to that is consistent with the Noor Pennington Doctrine's sham litigation exception. And otherwise, by saying this doesn't apply to legitimate representation of clients, that's completely consistent with a Noor Pennington Doctrine that has a sham litigation exception. With respect to the sham litigation exception, as the trial court properly found, appellants simply did not plead facts sufficient to trigger it in light of their allegations in the First Amendment complaint and the judicially noticeable facts. Counsel, I think, misstated what the serial litigation requirement what the pleading requirement for the serial litigation exception to Noor Pennington. It's not the fact that the court below found that because one of the litigations was successful, therefore it couldn't apply. Instead, the court below correctly focused on what this court has said is the pleading requirement, namely that the question isn't just whether any of the cases have merit, but whether they're brought pursuant to a policy of starting legal proceedings without regard to the merits and for the purpose of injuring a market foe. That's from this court in USS POSCO Industries. They didn't allege that. They didn't allege that Motorola has any sort of policy or practice of improper litigation. They only alleged that here in this case that these litigations were inappropriate and for an incorrect motive. I would also like to call the court's attention to an inconsistency that, despite the fact we've repeatedly attacked it, I don't think that appellants have ever addressed. And that's the discrepancy about when they say Motorola and Mr. Carlson obtained the knowledge that Mr. Pick was a witness of some sort and therefore got the intent to join retaliation against him. Although the First Amendment complaint says generally, without specifics, that Motorola and Mr. Carlson learned this in 2014, later in the complaint, as we show in our brief, the appellants argue in great detail that it was during the trial of the state court case in 2019 that Motorola and Mr. Carlson learned that Mr. Pick had made complaints against Mr. K and that he was a victim and a witness. And it was then, and they plead this very specifically, it was then that they gained the mens rea regarding why they were engaging in this litigation. Well, if that's the case, the RICO theory simply can't make sense, because then the Nevada cases are before they knew that he was a victim or witness, before they possibly could have had a common purpose to retaliate against a witness. And indeed, it shows that they started the Los Angeles case before knowing that. Even though those are inconsistent allegations, the very specific and detailed one should control over the general generic one, and that completely undermines their RICO claim.
Are you able to shed, counsel, I know this might go outside the merits of the issues before us, but are you able to shed any light on why Motorola is accepting litigation funding from this supposed stranger to their business? I was shocked that I guess Mr. Carlson admitted that that is in fact what's going on. Is
Your there Honor, anything you can say about I can't, that? I can't, based on anything in the record, Your Honor. But to tie that question to the issue before you, the question is, if you plead on information and belief that Mr. Carlson must have been bribed, then under Twombly and Iqbal, you have to show that there's not a just as good explanation that's plausible. You have to show that this thing you're coming up with is the only plausible explanation. And the notion that he was bribed is simply invented out of thin air. It's made up of nothing. A equally plausible interpretation is, hey, Motorola had this old judgment that it could get pursued for free without paying and without burdening the litigation costs of the litigation section.
So, counsel, is your answer to Judge Watford's question that there is no evidence that Motorola was paid anything or that, you know, anything that was anything like what was alleged? Is that your answer?
Your Honor, my answer is you're correct. There is nothing in the record supporting
I think my colleague asked you just overall.
Okay.
Can you enlighten us? Did they get involved?
Your Honor, if I understand your follow-up to Judge Watford's question, it is there anything in the record explaining from Motorola why they accepted this help? And the answer, I believe, is no. Not in the record before this court in this case. But there's certainly nothing in the record, and that's admitted by the information belief pleading, for this purely invented idea that the only reason this could have happened was that an individual was bribed and accepted bribes. Because there are plenty of alternate plausible explanations, including the one I just articulated, which is that it was a free chance to pursue a judgment and get money. And indeed, as the record shows, they succeeded in getting a judgment to get Mr. Pick for fraudulent transfer.
Now, what for our purposes, do we, if there are two explanations, one that shows scienter and the other just a perfectly innocent business reason, I want to collect money on my judgment, do we have some direction as to what we're to believe, which we're to pursue?
Yes, Your Honor. The cases we cite in our brief demonstrate that in that situation, under Twombly and Iqbal, the court need not accept an information and belief allegation when there are alternate explanations. That is not adequate pleading. That is not plausible pleading.
Okay. Let me ask my colleagues whether either has additional questions for Mr. White.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll give the rest of my time to my colleague.
Okay, Mr. Croson, you have 2 minutes.
We can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honors.
Okay.
We're all familiar with that. We've all done it.
Peter Croson on behalf of the K defendants. May it please the court. Your Honors, the district court found that the dismissal as to both defendants, Motorola and the K defendants, were based on the same grounds. So I will not go through the positions that Mr. White addressed. However, just generally with regard to the K defendants, what appellant's RICO claim is trying to do is choke the funding as to Motorola's legitimate and admitted $1.2 million judgment.
Mr. K be paying for Motorola to pursue that? Is he a collection agency of some kind? Does he have a deal to get a piece of the recovery?
No, Your Honor, and that's not in the record. The common purpose here with between Mr. K and Motorola is Motorola's legitimate judgment that they obtained. The case law
doesn't really interest Mr. K unless it's true that he's on a personal vendetta against Mr. Pick, which doesn't exactly put your client in a particularly good light.
Your Honor, under Nora Pennington, the case law is clear that funding a litigation is protected activity, just like bringing the litigation. And case law is also clear that the court is not to look to the particular motive of the person funding the litigation, just whether or not any of the exceptions apply. Our brief and the brief of co-counsel cites all of those cases. Funding is a legitimate protected activity.
So I want to be sure, following on my colleague's question here, you're telling us that under our case law, that if Mr. K just said, you know, I hate Pick's guts, and I have learned that Motorola has a judgment against him, I look at the record and I want to get that SOB, he can go to Motorola and with real scienter, with pure intention to harm him, he can fund the litigation, and it really doesn't matter so long as Motorola has a legitimate basis for its judgment. Is that what you're telling us?
In your hypothetical, Your Honor, I'll answer that question. Obviously, okay. That's not the case here.
Sure.
But yes, Your Honor, if the case law cited on our brief discusses the question is not to look at the motive behind it, but whether or not any of the exceptions to Nora Pennington apply. And here, neither the sham or the serial litigation type exceptions apply. So your hypothetical, Your Honor, it certainly paints a picture of a very bad individual. And that's not the situation here, and that's not the circumstances presented on this appeal. But yes, the case law does not require looking at the motive of the person funding.
So it doesn't matter what Mr. K's motive was, as long as it fits the exceptions in Nora Pennington, it doesn't matter. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the law.
Okay.
How many bites does it take to exceed the serial litigation problem? I mean, many times can you take a whack at somebody?
Well, I think it comes down to the threshold question first, Your Honor, as to whether or not the serial lawsuits have merit or not. And in this case, they have. The appellant acknowledges in his brief that several of the serial litigations were successful. So I don't really have an answer to your question. How many times can you knock someone with frivolous lawsuits that have no merit? But the burden is on appellant to show that in order to cite serial litigation, that they were objectively baseless, and that's not in the record.
Now we have in this case have focused on the Motorola related material, but as I understand it, there were a lot of earlier unrelated lawsuits between Pick and K, or that was initiated by K. Should we take those others into account, or are we limited by considering the Motorola cases?
I don't think the other cases should be taken into account, Your Honor. The RICO statute has a 4-year statute of limitations, and the majority, overwhelming majority of those cases fall outside of that statute.
Okay. Other questions by my colleagues or Mr. Croson? All right. Hearing none. Mr. Alexis, I don't think you have much time, but let's see what you've got here. There we are. I've got 10 seconds. We're going to give you a minute and 10 seconds, so go for it.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could quickly add one more point to Judge Clifton and Judge Watford's question. A central issue in the renewal of judgment in the lower court was Mr. Carlson's declaration that no portion of the judgment had been assigned or alienated. And that's a very key issue on the California Assignment of Judgments law, whether a judgment can be renewed. So that's a very pertinent fact that, in the renewal of judgment, before there was any indication of this kind of relationship, there was an affirmative declaration that Mr. K is getting no finance, that Motorola simply owns this judgment. It hasn't been assigned in any sense or shape. With respect to the merits of the cases that they've been successful, if a federal informant knows that the moment they step up and speak to the government, all of a sudden all their neighbors have unlimited funding to litigate all their property boundary disputes, that will undermine the VWPA.
Counsel, with respect, you've now gone over your time, and I think we have the gist of your argument. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
We thank you. We thank counsel for Motorola and for Mr. K for your arguments in this case. The case just argued is submitted. And we wish you a good day.